Hi, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to Toy Harp, a podcast about bluegrass. This is the last episode of season two. Here from Nashville is my conversation with Allison Krauss.
I remember, you know, the first time I looked out in the audience and saw people singing words to our songs that only we had recorded. That was just a really crazy moment. Just never thought it'd end up being there. Never thought we'd hear back from Rounder. Yeah. Never thought we would hear from Rounder in the first place.
If this is your first time listening, you can hear full interviews with Jerry Douglas, Allison Brown, Bela Fleck, Larry Sparks, Jody Stecker, and so many more wherever you get your podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Later on.
The Breakdown is sponsored by the Soundtrack of America, Made in Tennessee, and on this episode we're talking about a much-loved movie that charts a sweeping journey across the American South. Well, you can tailor your own epic music-inspired road trip with Tennessee Music Pathways, a statewide program that preserves the legacy of music in Tennessee. From blues to bluegrass, soul to rock and roll, you'll find plenty for your perfect soundtrack. So if you want to visit the places that inspired so many of the records we talk about on this podcast, check out TNVacation.com to start planning your trip. And now, on with the show. Hello, and welcome to The Breakdown, the podcast that uncovers the greatest sounds and stories in bluegrass music, one iconic record at a time.
I'm Patrick McGonigal, the fiddle player with the Lonely Heartstring Band.
And I'm Emma John, author, journalist, and all-round bluegrass novice. Today we're discussing the soundtrack to Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?, the Coen Brothers film that was without doubt the most influential and important thing to happen to bluegrass music in the 21st century. The movie, which starred George Clooney, Tim Blake Nelson and John Turturro, was released in 2000, and it's kind of single-handedly responsible for introducing old-timey Americana music to an entire generation that includes myself. The soundtrack showcases songs from deep in the old-time and bluegrass archives, and it introduced artists like Gillian Welch and the Cox family and the Fairfield Four to a global audience. But also the movie itself is just a total delight. I mean, it's so much fun. And it was the first time we all discovered that George Clooney was really good at comic acting as well.
Right. It was also the first time that we all realized that George Clooney sounds just like Dan Tominski when he sings.
It's amazing. How crazy is that?
How crazy is that?
I love this movie. It's clearly a love letter from the Coen brothers to a music that they care about as well. And there was nothing in their pre-Oh Brother catalogue that would necessarily have told you they could make a film like this.
Right. And they seem to kind of really be thorough with their gathering up of all of the biggest stars in the American acoustic old-time bluegrass world and putting them all in front of microphones and getting them to play for this record. This is a who's who of the year 2000 in American music.
Oh, they totally did their research. They and obviously they used T-Bone Burnett, the producer, as their kind of I guess their channel into that world, as their expert in that world. And he'd been producing the first couple of Gillian Welch's records, and he had done research for Coen Brothers before, musical research before. He did the music for The Big Lebowski.
Yeah.
Which apparently Man of Constant Sorrow was originally slated to be on. T-Bone found that song and offered it up to them for Big Lebowski. Obviously, he never made it, and that...
Well, it got its second chance. And then some.
I guess it probably just really wasn't right for the dude.
No, the dude is more chill than Constant Sorrow.
So this was the Coen brothers' first what they called soundtrack movie. In other words, the music came first. T-Bone Burnett worked on the songs and everything had been recorded before they shot the movie. So the actual scenes themselves ended up being influenced by what was happening in the music, which is pretty cool. And you can see how important that all is from literally the opening shots of the movie. Before we even see anything, you hear the clink of the rocks as the chain gang are, you know, doing this kind of rhythmic clinking of their, what are they, pickaxes on the rocks, breaking the rocks. I just think the fact that the whole movie starts with just a beat, just like a rhythmic beat, is really cool and tells you how important music's going to be to the whole thing.
And all of the kind of scenes and the kind of the characters that are surrounding the main characters, the kind of the communities that the main characters pass through, are kind of embodied by the music throughout the film. So at the beginning you get the black chain gang, and they're holding that first scene, and then when they're down at the river getting baptized, there's this whole kind of religious community and they're singing down to the river to pray, and then you've got these kind of weird political rallies and there's these little family bands playing. So each kind of scene also is given its musical context in a way that really kind of I think is trying to reflect the emotional makeup of the communities that they're passing through as the story goes on. It's really great.
Yeah, one of the things I love about the juxtaposition of the first two songs, the James Carter and the Prisoners singing Poe Lazarus, and then the immediate cut to Big Rock Candy Mountain, is that it sets up this tension between the harsh reality of the chain gang and the harsh reality of America and the Depression, and then the escapist fantasy of these hobos, well, in their case,
little streams
prisoners.
Of alcohol come trickling down the rocks.
It's beautiful, and it to me that sums up the movie.
In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, you never change your socks, and the little streams of alcohol come a-trickling down the rocks. The brakemen have to tip their hats, and the railroad bulls are blind. There's a lake of stew and a whiskey, too. You can paddle all around them in a big canoe in the Big Rock Candy Mountains.
T-Bone Burnett said about Man of Constant Sorrow that he thought that song also captured that tone, which was epic and dead serious on one hand and comic and affable on the other. Mm-hmm. So I think that's entirely what they were going for. Obviously, we need to talk about Man of Constant Sorrow, because that is, it's the song that the entire movie is based around, that the plot hinges on, and it's the song that Dan Tominski will now be asked to play for the rest of his life.
Constant sorrow all through his days. I am a man of constant sorrow. I've seen trouble all my days.
Has that song become a ball and chain at all? Like, do you have to sing it? Do you get requests for it?
Oh God, you know what? Quite the opposite. I would have to say, I would say not only is it not a ball and chain, but the thought of I grew up playing a type of music that a lot of people, you know, it's kind of a niche music. It's not, you know, it's not for the big crowds typically. If you play music for a living and you are lucky enough to have someone, you know, love a song that you do and have a song mean that much to that many people, and you don't love that song, man, you probably have deeper issues that might suggest you shouldn't be playing music. I've never played that song, and I've played it every single show I've done since. I've never played that song where it does not get a reaction. And for most of this past 20 years, honestly, it's the last song we do. We end our show with it because there's just no, it's just hard to top it still. Yeah. 20 years later, people still in the crowd will get up, dance along. People are walking up in the front, pulling their fake beards and, you know, yeah, and doing the thing like, no, oh my God, I would give anything to have something else that would make people that happy. I would never say ball and chain. If there's an opposite of a ball and chain, that's what that song is.
Helium balloon.
It's a helium balloon. Thank you. A Zeppelin of sorts. Yes. in a situation that I've never been in. I mean, even recording for the movie, that, you know, we didn't use headphones and we didn't use, you know, modern microphone. I mean, we used old microphones, old instruments. We recorded it. They wanted it to be 100% organic and pure. There were no overdubs. There were no tricks or fancy, you know, there was just no studio trickery. You had to sit down and do it start to finish.
You really were just singing into a can.
I was singing into a can. Yeah. We didn't use that can, but you know, I was singing into a microphone of that period. Yes. With a guitar from that period. Yeah. They made sure all the instruments we played were right, were to spec. So it was interesting. And, we had to think about what was going on visually in the movie during parts of it, because there's, you know, a fight broke out and the song had to stop and then it had to kick back in and it had to start. But so there was a lot of direction, you know, visual direction of what was going on while we're playing. They kept describing what we were supposed to be portraying. And T-Bone, I remember he kept saying, look, it's got to have more, like you just stole a chicken. It's like you've sold your soul to the devil for your musical ability, and it's you're desperate. And if you really kill this song, you know, if you can like really just rock it out, only, you know, but rock hasn't been invented, but it's like rock and roll, like, you know, as he said, it's just, he kept explaining. And finally I grabbed the guitar because I had an idea, and I kind of just put it out of tune. I tuned the string way down, left it kind of a little sloppy and played it really rattly, like, you know, the version is. And within seconds, you know, they all stood up, and it was funny because that was the first thing they said. They said, can you play and sing at the same time? And I found myself, after having done this, you know, for decades of playing and singing at the same time, thinking about it and going, I don't know. Like, I was like, because it was, I do this, but I will see. When I called my wife at the time to tell her that I was going to get this voiceover, she was very excited because she's a big Clooney fan. She goes, oh, a voiceover, that is so great. That's great. What is that? And I explained that, you know, in this case, when you're at the movies, you'll be looking up at the big screen, seeing George Clooney singing, but hearing my voice coming out. And without hesitation, she said, Dan, that's my fantasy. Kudos to Clooney. His job was way, way, way harder than my job. I got to sing it, you know, just however I sing it. Mm-hmm. He had to learn someone else's every little nuance and phrasing, and he sold it. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I can't imagine how many times that poor guy listened to that song. There was a point that he wanted to sing it. We were filming when I was made aware of this, and we had already, of course, finished all the music, and it was done. We were filming in Vicksburg, Mississippi, and we were working on the scene where they ride that guy out on the rail, you know, the big scene where the fight breaks out, where the band is playing Constant Sorrow. And there was a day off. We filmed for one day. There was a day off, and T-Bone came up and said, listen, he said, Clooney wants to sing the song. He said, would you go in the studio with him tomorrow? We have a studio rented. You know, contrary to what a lot of people, I've heard a lot of comments, you know, Clooney can sing. I mean, he could have done this if he demanded it and said, no, just let me do it. It would have been fine. Like, he could sing. Yeah. But part of this gig was, if we skip back, it had to be one take, start to finish. There were no punches. There were no, if you made a mistake, it was on there forever. So I think that was what ultimately led to what happened, because we went in the studio and I played it with him and he was singing it fine, you know, but we got through, you know, second or third verse, he made a mistake or sang the wrong word and he goes, we need to start it again. So, you know, I started again and he sang a little bit less and made a mistake. And then I started again and I didn't probably start that song, but maybe three or four or five times max. And each time he sang a little less, and after that fourth or fifth time, you know, he took his headphones off and walked out. He says, Tominski, I don't know what we're doing in here. He goes, listen, I'm going to make you a deal. I'll act, you sing. And he shook my hand, right? I was completely disappointed. Like, I thought, man, you know, like, you're not even trying.
Sure, I'll fly away. I'll Fly Away is another one of those songs that, you know, any one of my non-bluegrass loving friends will now know. And Alison Krauss and Gillian Welch's version is now the
quintessential
watermark.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nobody has ever made old time music as sexy as Emmylou Harris and Alison Krauss and Gillian Welch in Don't Need Nobody But the Baby.
That is a very, very beautiful song, and the scene of the movie
is
holy moly.
It's incredible. And considering that just before that, I think Alison Krauss and Gillian Welch have sung I'll Fly Away, which sounds so ethereal and otherworldly. And then you add Emmylou Harris's voice to the mix and suddenly it's something completely different. It's so much more kind of flesh and blood and earthy.
Yep.
And then, is there a saw in the background? There's a little whistling sound that I think might be a saw.
Go to sleep, you little babe.
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 Your mama's gone away and your dad's gonna stay. Don't leave nobody but the baby.
And then our main character gets turned into a toad.
Yeah. Causing the most quotable line of the movie.
We thought you was a toad.
There's a lot of folklore involved in that's referenced in the movie as well. And of course, one of those amazing pieces of folklore is the idea of selling your soul to the devil at the crossroads. Something that fiddle players know all about because...
I mean, I sold my soul in 1999, still waiting for the magical fiddle power. Anyways, continue.
Yeah, it's always been slightly associated with violins, this idea that the devil plays the fiddle, so it's the fiddle's instrument. I think they used to call it the devil's box. That used to be a name for the violin.
Paganini definitely sold his soul to the devil.
Yeah.
A lot of folklore around that.
And in the movie... the character Tommy Johnson is picked up at the crossroads, having apparently just sold his soul for the ability to play guitar real good.
Chris Thomas King, Tommy Johnson, is playing guitar and singing on the great Hard Time Killing Floor Blues, which he plays and sings around a campfire in the movie, I think.
At the campfire scene, when I'm singing Hard Time Killing Floor Blues, that song is live to video. When they say action, that's those crickets are real, you know, and that's a real fire. And we're really sitting there and I'm really playing and singing that song. And that is that was like 3 a.m. or something out on the Disney Ranch, the Ponderosa, where they used to shoot these cowboys and stuff. And we're out there in the middle of the night. And it's like a real folk recording where you just go out in the field with a, you know, in the woods somewhere and find some rustic musician and ask him to play and sing a song for you. That's pretty much what that is.
Hard time, yeah, where you go, has it harder than ever been before. And people are drifting from door to door. Can't find no heaven, I don't care where they go. Say I had money.
I had not done any major acting until Old Brother Warthog. That was my first role. I'm not a person that's easily impressed, but I was definitely impressed when I showed up on the set. And I had long dreadlocks, like dreadlocks that run down my back. I had been all through the 80s, I had dreadlocks. And but I didn't cut my hair for the audition or anything. But they told me that once I had the role, you know, I would have to cut my hair so I could look period. So that morning I said, well, I'm not going to do it until the day that we film, just in case, you know, something happens. But After my 5 a.m. haircut or whatever it was, I showed up on the set. And the first day I showed up and got out the van and went over, you know, and there was this guy in overalls, greasy guy, you know, came over. Hey, how you doing? Welcome to the set. This is great, isn't it? A little small talk. And then he asked me would I like some coffee. He went and made me some coffee and brought it back to me. And then I heard somebody say, you know, George, you know, you need it on the set or whatever, you know. So I showed up on the set and George Clooney was making me coffee and making me feel comfortable. And, you know, he was just a real pro. And so when it was time to do scenes with him that day, you know, it was, you know, I felt comfortable. So, and that's the whole, and that's how you get a good scene. You try to make people feel comfortable. But I won't name names in this podcast, but I've done some movies with some other folks. They won't even show up, you know, if they're not doing a tight shot on their face, they're not even going to show up to run their lines. You know, it was my first experience. I thought all movies was going to be that way, but that was a very special thing. And the stars just lined up for us because I think I went out to dinner with T-Bone Burnett. We were in Jackson, Mississippi filming. And he invited me out to lunch and something like that. And we talked about the music. And I think I was trying to pitch him one of my tunes, John Law Burns on a Liquor Store or something like that. But they wanted to use all period pieces. And he was telling me that the soundtrack was going to be a big deal and it was going to sell, you know, millions of records. And if I'm not mistaken, he told me it was going to sell 10 million copies sitting there. And of course, I just thought he was nuts, you know? It's like, this kind of music, nobody, you know, I've been making these records. I mean, of course, Ralph Stanley and everybody else been making it. I mean, we don't even think of anything like a platinum record, you know? So, but he was right. I mean, he really, you know, he's kind of a cocky guy. If you don't really know him, he comes off kind of cocky and way too self-assured, you know? But yeah. And then with a name like T-Bone Burnett, you know, excuse me, what's your real name? But everything that he said and all the choices and things that he made as the music supervisor and the producer of the album, you know, came to fruition. So it was just, like I said, it was one of those things where the stars just lined up and I've never been a part of anything like that since.
Oh, dear. Oh, Dad, won't you spare me over till another year?
If Man of Constant Sorrow was the most recognizable song from the movie and the one that probably, you know, now gets most asked for every time a bluegrass band gets up on stage, the second most recognizable one would be Ralph Stanley singing Oh, Death. It certainly completely revived his career and brought him to an entire new audience. But I think it's kind of a shocker watching it back to remember that this song that, you know, made Ralph Stanley apparently a lot of money was actually coming out of the, on screen, it's coming out of the mouth of a grandmaster of the KKK, which is a pretty difficult thing to watch.
Very difficult to watch, and also must have been quite a shock for Ralph Stanley and anyone involved in the making of this record.
I can speak for everyone else that didn't know when we saw it coming out, and there was a whole, like in the theater even.
You didn't know what that song was being used for until you saw it.
No, we did. We had a script, so the ones who read through this script knew. But you still, you know, but you still don't know. You still, you think you know, you don't know.
Yeah.
You see it and like jaws just drop and it's like, wow. Like really, wow.
Yeah.
Right? Again, the Coens have a way to take the most sensitive things like that and still somehow make them palatable to where you don't walk away feeling ultimately offended or, you know, really horrible about it. So thank you for how they treated it so that, you know, we didn't have to have any blemish on Ralph.
A scene like that, you know, for a black actor can really, it can be, if it's not presented properly, if it's not handled well, you know, it can be a scene that you regret even being involved in, you know. But somehow they handled that in a way that well, people could see that scene and they can see the Klan and see me, you know, stressed out about, you know, what's getting ready to happen and laugh about it. And, you know, I mean, how do you even do that? You know, people laugh at that scene and it's not even controversial to laugh at it, you know, because it's funny. You know, we were clowning around. I think I have photos of myself posing, you know, with all these Klan guys, you know, in different poses, making fun.
I'll fix your feet till you can't walk. I'll lock your jaw till you can't talk. I'll close your eyes so you can't see this very hour. Come and go with me.
Ralph Stanley didn't necessarily know that his voice was going to be pinned on to a grandmaster of the KKK. But further, you know, what it did for Ralph Stanley's career, I have a story about that, which is that I got to see Ralph Stanley play many times before he passed. And the first time I saw him play was at the Fresh Grass Festival in about 2009 or 10. Now, Fresh Grass is a festival in Massachusetts, in Western Mass. And he did his whole set and he was great. And he sang a lot of songs. And his closer, of course, was a solo, O Death. And the crowd went wild for it. And he got off stage and they were going crazy. And his encore, he comes back up, sings O Death again, exactly the same way. Crowd goes wild again. He walks off stage. They won't let him get away with it. Second encore, Ralph comes up and sings O Death a third time, three times in a row. Every time the audience got more and more excited. This song became Ralph Stanley's anthem. It was just such a huge hit for him.
He wrote in his biography that he originally was asked to accompany that was banjo. That was how it was originally recorded. T-Bone wanted him to play banjo in the background. And it was Ralph's idea to do it a cappella.
It was a good idea, Ralph.
It was a good idea, Ralph. Although in the movie scene itself, you do get this kind of beat. There's something going on in the background that makes it a lot more sinister, even more sinister.
Yeah, because it really is. It's not a sinister song. It's a very kind of pensive, introverted moment, really, that, you know.
It's not sinister? I mean, it's got lines where Death is saying, I'll fix your feet so you can't walk. I'll lock your jaw so you can't talk. I'll close your eyes so you can't see. I find that frightening.
But it is frightening. I don't see it as sinister. I think it's legitimately somebody contemplating what death does to a person.
You got to go to the Lonesome Valley.
Speaking of powerful songs, the Fairfield Four's Lonesome Valley is another great kind of rumbling moment on the record, second to last track, and it's huge, and it's this wall of voices that just it really is you know, just like in the end of the movie, not to give it away, but the whole valley is flooded and these walls of water come over. The Fairfield Four singing Lonesome Valley has that same impact.
There's often multiple layers of things going on with the song choices. I think it's very clever the way that Keep on the Sunny Side is the song that is attached to it's attached to the political campaign of Homer Stokes, who's the reform candidate for this governor position, and you know, you feel like he's supposed to be the good guy, and of course later it's revealed that he's the guy under the KKK hood, and there's this real kind of cruel humor and irony in the fact that he's got these, you know, very wholesome looking people up on stage.
There's a dark and a troubled side of life, but there's a bright and a sunny side too. Though you meet with the darkness and strife, the sunny side you also may view. Keep on the sunny side, always on.
I didn't know that the Keep on the Sunny Side was not written by the Carter family. It's often credited to A.P. Carter, but apparently it was written in 1899 by Ada Blenkhorn, and it's actually about a literal sunny side. She wrote it as a hymn because her nephew was in a wheelchair and used to like to be pushed down the sunny side of the street.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. On the sunny side of life, it will help us every day. It will brighten all the way if we'll keep on the sunny side of life.
There are so many amazing musicians on this soundtrack that it's hard to mention them all. The people we haven't talked about yet include the little girls, the Peasel sisters, who in reality, they're not seen on screen because there's young actors playing the Peasel sisters. There's young actors playing the Warby girls, i.e. George Clooney's children on screen. But the girls singing in the highways and in the hedges were Leah and Hannah and Sarah Peasel. And as a result of this soundtrack, I think they were 6 and 9 and 11 or something, they ended up going on tour for 10 years.
In the highways, in the hedges, in the highways, in the hedges, in the highways, in the hedges, I'll be somewhere working for my Lord. I'll be somewhere working.
I think you can probably also hear them on Down to the River to Pray, because Alison Krauss is backed by their own church choir in that.
Wow.
The First Baptist Church Choir of White House, Tennessee, which is where the Peasel sisters were singing at the time. They also sang on the Coen Brothers remake of True Grit. And they're now two of them. They're obviously all grown up now. Two of them are singer-songwriters in Nashville. And the other one is a worship leader for a church in Nashville.
Kiss me, mother, kiss your darling, lay my head upon your breast, throw your loving arms around me, I am
two bands that we see on stage in the political rallies that are actual bands are the Whites, who sing Keep on the Sunny Side, and then the Cox family sing I Am Weary. But they actually had to take a huge furlough from music straight after Oh Brother Where Art Thou, which, you know, it was quite tragic, really. They had just had this huge hit and been in this movie. And almost immediately after the movie came out, the paterfamilias of the Cox family, as her brother would call him, Willard, and his wife, Marie, were in a car accident. They were hit by a logging truck, and it left Willard in a wheelchair, and Marie was pretty badly injured as well. And the family just stopped touring, stopped performing, and just went home to care for the parents. So they ended up not recording again for literally over a decade. something like 13 years. But they are now touring again with Alison Krauss. I think we should mention the cameos.
Mention the cameos.
Gillian Welch can be seen on screen as she's there just for a moment. She's a woman standing asking a shopkeeper if they've got a copy of Soggy Bottom Boys.
Yeah.
And they don't because they've sold out.
They've sold out.
But yeah, I would not have known that was Gillian Welch if I hadn't gone and looked that up. What was it like being on set and actually having to put on the costume and stand in front of the cameras?
Like, I love doing that stuff anyway. If I didn't play music, I would want to act. Like, that's totally fun for me. But I can remember dressing up, like, everything, again, very authentic. So I had, it was crazy. My pants came up to just below, you know, my boobs, right? Pants are up here. Had these little shirt suspenders, right? And it was... By the time I put everything on, and of course, then they basically shaved my head and shaved my beard off. And I said, I really would like to keep the mustache if I could. And they said, oh, no problem. You can keep the mustache. And as he was doing, Clooney walks behind me. And Clooney said, hey, what if you give one of them little pencil mustaches? And the guy goes, oh, great idea. You know, so there goes the mustache, right? So I had this little tiny, you know, line and head shaved and beard shaved and... And then after they did all that, they put a hat on me, so it didn't matter. I didn't need the haircut. But anyway, so I did all this stuff, and I remember I walked in, and I was in front of the mirror in the little, you know, in the little Honeywell, in the little, you know, the dressing room that they give you, a little camper dressing room. And I had the damnedest tickle in my stomach. Like, I was laughing. I could not walk out into the public yet. Like, it was, I started to go out. I remember reaching for the door, and I was really laughing so hard, and I had to stop. I was like, okay, come on, Timmons, get over yourself. Like, it was so weird, because with the haircut, with everything, I was a different person.
And I'm kind of in character, because I'm not able to really perform it as Chris Thomas King. That's something that people might miss about my role. It's kind of understated. I mean, I'm not playing myself, you know. This is a fictional character, and I was directed to act, and therefore I had to sing and play almost in a way that was not my style. I mean, I was doing rap blues and hip-hop blues and you know, rocking out with my Marshall amps and stuff on my Stratocaster when I got the call. So I wasn't playing finger-picking blues, you know. I mean, I could play it a little bit, but it really wasn't my thing, because I was going to play it with a slide guitar, that piece, but T-Bone said he didn't want it slide, he wanted a finger pick, and they sent me to Nashville to work with a Canadian guy named Colin Linden, and I spent a couple of days on Music Row in one of these little songwriter runs, where, because he had studied all this finger picking stuff from all the Delta guys, and they wanted me to spend a day with him, and we struck up a nice friendship, and he, you know, showed me how he approached the style, and I took some things from him and put my own thing to it and came up with that arrangement for it. So it's a unique arrangement for Hard Time Killing Poor Blues, and it's a song that almost nobody had ever heard before then. It was a very obscure Skip James song, you know. I didn't know a lot about Skip James. I didn't know a lot about Tommy Johnson. I almost knew nothing about Tommy Johnson, other than, you know, the Can He tune and things like that. But I wasn't like a blues scholar or anything, you know. I never appreciated their anthropologic, you know, approach to my culture, you know. And it's like I'm a musician. I mean, I'm trying to get on MTV or make it to Soul Train, you know, and you guys, you know, want to present me like I'm some kind of specimen in a zoo, you know, and so these anthropologists and these folklorists like the John Lomaxes and stuff, they irritate me because they distort, you know, the music culture I come from.
I think it's important to note that this movie is guilty of a classic Hollywood trope of the white savior, the white
savior complex,
the white savior that goes in and saves the African-American and it makes all of the white audiences feel great about that particular moment.
And you're
in the
also
movie.
Concerned about the fact that the prisoners in who sing Poe Lazarus are obviously never credited, because at the time that the song was collected, Alan Lomax did not, you know, collect their names. The only named musician on that song is James Carter.
Yeah.
So you believe there's a sort of element of cultural appropriation.
I think there's an element of cultural appropriation, and it's also indicative of a larger pattern of American music history, and Alan Lomax being part of that.
Although I would say, in his defense, that when the movie came out and when the soundtrack came out and became a success, his daughter went off specifically to try and track down James Carter, and succeeded. And they found him living in Chicago, 76 years old. He didn't even remember having recorded this song, and they were able to present him with the first of what turned out to be many royalty checks.
And that's great. And I think that's great, but it's also the very, very rare exception to the case in regards to a lot of Lomax's recordings and a lot of just African-American music in general of the 20th century.
My latest son is taking phase, my race is nearly run, my strongest trials now are past, my triumph has begun.
There's often a bit of discussion around this record about the fact that people refer to Oh Brother Where Art Thou as the Coen Brothers bluegrass movie, and people from the scene will tell you, actually, you know, this isn't bluegrass because the whole thing's set in the Depression era. Bluegrass hadn't been invented. This is pre-war music, and it's pre-bluegrass music, but it's definitely the kind of mountain music that was the precursor to bluegrass, and you can hear bluegrass rhythms all over the shop on this record.
And another really cool part about this movie and soundtrack is that after it was all over, there was a tour put together that included almost all of the musicians from the soundtrack, and they did a big tour together. They made a DVD documentary about it called Down from the Mountain, and it seems like that was a really big moment in a lot of their careers as well, and something that they all really enjoyed.
This movie ended up being number one on the pop charts, which is incredible when you think about it. But it took its time to get there. The soundtrack came out, obviously, alongside the movie in 2000. The movie had left theaters by August 2001, and the soundtrack didn't actually become number one until March 2002, 2 years later.
Wow.
Apparently that's the longest climb to number one in the pop charts that there's ever been. Also, quick question for you.
Yep.
There had only been one other soundtrack to win Best Album at the Grammys before Oh Brother. Can you guess what it was?
I'm going to go ahead and guess The Bodyguard.
You're right.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm only guessing that because I know that Whitney Houston's I Will Always Love You is on that, and that was one of the biggest songs ever. But I'm right.
You're right.
I'm actually right. This is a real guess, folks. I'm going to give myself some credit for that one.
While we talk about awards, I would like to say that I feel like there should be a category in the Oscars or something just for Tim Blake Nelson's face, because that face deserves its own little accolade.
I wonder who would win that. He would stand a good chance of winning it.
I think he would stand a good chance.
What Old Brother did for me, and I'm sure it did the same for the other musicians on the album, it became such a phenomenon that we broke out of our little niches, you know. I was kind of like a cult, you know, like a people in the blues circles knew who I was, like that very small community. But instead of just being in Living Blues magazine, I found myself being written about in People magazine and Entertainment Weekly and, you know, the New York Times or whatever, you know, Time magazine. It really broke me out of of being just a blues artist who was supposed to carry on this tradition to where I could be more of a kind of be more of a free artistic artist where I can create, you know, blues art.
I can certainly attest that crowds for bluegrass festivals, let's say like at the time I was in southwestern part of Virginia. The festivals that were little local festivals that were used to having, you know, they had been running for years and they had a predictable, you know, crowd. I mean, everything tripled. Attendance tripled. Man, after that, we started seeing, you know, we just another complete demographic. I mean, we started seeing, every, you know, kids with rock and roll t-shirts and spiked hairs and, you know, chains in their face. Like people yeah. we never saw, like in our normal crowd. They were just, it struck young people, old people, you know, educated people, you know, country redneck people. It just, it drew from every corner. It was amazing to watch.
Do you get people quoting the movie at you? I feel like you must get forever. People calling you Big Dan, for sure.
So, well, what's wrong? What's the matter, Big Dan? I get that. It's neat to be attached to something like that when people do that. Yeah, it just, again, it brings it back and you remember that, wow, I was pretty damn lucky.
You're a Dapper Dan man.
I am a Dapper Dan man forevermore. I still have my Dapper Dan can.
So thank you very much to Dan Tominski for coming over on a Friday afternoon and chatting with us for a couple of hours. Not only about O Brother, Where Art Thou, but also about the best bourbon in the world. Also, thank you very much to Chris Thomas King for chatting with us about this record.
That's all for this episode. Thank you to our sponsor, The Soundtrack of America, Made in Tennessee. And don't forget to check out tnvacation.com to start planning your trip now.